Chili Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck O'Shelly.
June 2nd, 2022, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. And this indeed is the show you were looking for. How do I know that? Because I'm saying this. I'm almost wondering if I should ever bother to say the date again. Because doesn't matter. Everybody listens at a different time. I get complaints, comments, and compliments even from stuff I did 3 months ago that somebody just decided to put through their feed. So I don't know. What am I going to do? As I speak, it is a Thursday, and it's the second to last broadcast day of the week of the show. Now, normally I would have Mike Swanson on in the first hour, but let's get somebody else in here who can have an intelligent conversation, because Mike is off today. And in the second hour, we got Joseph L. Flatley, and I'm not sure if we'll have J.G. Michael. Everything's been a little bit loosely planned lately. And I did hear back from Jefferson Morley, who was supposed to be on last night. Totally dropped the ball. I mean, I even had his publisher send me the book and everything. Anyway, Jeff is supposed to be on Monday. Let's see how that goes. Okay, so there's your updates. Oh, I didn't mention who I got in the first hour, did I? Glenn Vikeland is with me now. Glenn has been on the show quite a few times to discuss quite a few issues. And, you know, met him through the device, basically, of the JFK assassination. Now, him and I might not agree, ultimately, on the conclusions regarding this. We might not at all agree. But we did come to some points of agreement about, you know, certain fraudsters and things in the universe of the JFK assassination research community. And that's fair enough. And besides that, I don't need to have everybody agree with me. I would rather learn from those who disagree with me and actually bring, you know, facts, information, evidence. It's always good to do that, and you can still disagree. But anyway, we're going to hear from Glenn because he's got a perspective that is, not American. And, you know, we get our heads stuck up in our own backsides a little too long here, and we tend to think the whole world thinks like us. So I think it's a good idea once in a while to definitely get another point of view. I intend to ask Glenn about a couple of things. Now, some things might be right in his wheelhouse, the stuff he should know, understand, and be able to relate to right away. Other things, you know what? His observations will be decidedly different from yours and mine, but let's see what we can learn about what's actually going on. Anyway, Glenn, how you doing tonight?
Hello, Chuck. I'm fine, thank you. Even though it's late, or early, I should say. It's 2 o'clock in the morning over here.
Oh, yeah, 2 a.m. Friars Day, Friday, right? So, yeah. little ahead. We're speaking to Glenn in the future. It's even worse when I talk to people in Australia because I really get lost what day it is, everything. You know, you're just a few hours ahead. And I'm really grateful that you stay up to do this every now and then. Not everybody in Europe will stay awake to talk to me at this time of day, so I really appreciate that. Yeah,
no problem.
So, anyway, look, let's get to some brass tacks here. Now, are you still involved with the Swedish government? I mean, do you still have a position there?
If I'm involved in politics, you mean?
Well, I mean, are you involved as in you have some sort of a voice in the Swedish government?
Not in the government, no. I've never had. I am active in politics for the Social Democrats over here in the, but that's local politics only.
Yeah.
It's never been government.
Yeah, no problem. But local politics, that is government, because obviously there are decisions made by politicians on a local level, but you're not involved with the national government, is what you're saying. It's just localized.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
No, I want to make that clear.
It's quite a big place now. It's growing fast. We're soon to be 50,000 people here where I live. So, and I am in the sort of deciding council, you know. So it's interesting. It's a new experience of mine since 3 years back, and it's been fun. Quite a lot of work and quite a lot to read and write as well. So it's been interesting. It's been a fast learning curve, I should say.
Right. Well, anyway, either way,
everything is formally conducted. You know,
yes.
I've always been politically interested, so that's not new. Of course not. But you know how they exactly do it. You know, with all the formalities and all that. Well, it sounds dull, but it's necessary, I guess. So.
Well, sure,
so
sure.
That's been quite an experience.
Well, look, there are plenty of people that comment on various governments' behaviors and actions who have no clue about how they function at all, not on a local level, not on a national level, not on a regional level. People just have delusions about the way things work sometimes. Somebody who's actually doing something, at least you have a direct window into part of the process, which eventually, I'm sure, filters into the national conversation. One way or another, whether you got 50,000, 5,000, or even five people, represented by a place, it is relevant. And certainly you would have greater contact with individuals that live where you live. Now, we will talk about economic things in general if we have time, but I want to get right to the international political thing that is happening that does involve the nation that you live in. And let's begin with the Ukraine war because, well, what happened? All right, let's not, devolve into the whole discussion again, because I've already paid plenty of prices and had people turn on me now for adopting apparently the wrong point of view. I don't want to talk about my point of view or yours on the war necessarily. What I do want to discuss is the overall national reaction, because we did read recently that Sweden was actively looking to join NATO. And I'm just curious about...
It's true.
Yeah. So I'm curious about this because, obviously, this is one of those things that... there was more controversy over Finland, I guess, based on its geographical location, because Finland was one of these places that was supposedly wanting to join as well. And there is the back and forth about, about Putin saying this is about NATO aggression, okay. So I'm just curious, if you know anything about how that is or what the general consensus might have been in Sweden previous to this, because I never thought of even Sweden as wanting to join NATO.
No, but you're right. You're absolutely right. One should always remember that we've been out of any sort of military alliance for 200 years, basically. Even though, as most people, I'm sure, by now know, that we have quite a close exchange with the U.S., and we've had that for 50 years by now. So, there's been a lot going on that has not been publicly known, perhaps, as much.
Right.
But that's been a fact. So these 200 years, we've had peace, and that's a strong argument, and has been a strong argument, and it is still many people who don't like the fact that we're now going to join NATO. There's no question about that, but I think there is a majority. I think somewhere around 70-75%, I should say.
Right.
Somewhere there.
Now, again,
it's a majority, but it's been, and the critics are also, they don't like the fact that this has been a very quick one. Normally, it's a big decision, obviously, for Sweden. Now, so has real democracy been applied to this process? And some people say no, and I would be lying if I said it's been perfect, because it has not. Where all the political parties have their internal discussions and come to conclusions, it's been a very quick process, especially for my own party. Here we are, and to make a long story short, I think in the end that this was and is the right decision for Sweden now. And I can go into that on a deeper level. But, I think the decision was right. And I think now, though, we have Turkey. They don't want us in here. Erdogan in Turkey is putting all kinds of demands on Sweden. And I think a little bit on Finland as well. We have an arms embargo on Turkey since long. Mm-hmm. And they want us to lift that. And they also obviously want us to... declare that a couple of organizations that we allow here in Sweden are regarded as terrorists, and they are not. At least one of them, the PKK, obviously has been ruled a terrorist organization, even in the US and in Sweden. But
right.
But not another one, and that's what he wants. So he has a long list, and there has been now negotiations for some time. I believe for a week or something by now,
right.
And not much have come out from that. So I don't know exactly where it stands, but But I think also, you know, one should always remember that Erdogan has he has an upcoming election.
Right.
And so I would assume that a lot of this is because he wants to impress his own people more than anything else, you know. I think if I were to guess something today, I think that what might happen is that Sweden might take away at least a bit of the weapons and sell them some weapons. We have very sophisticated weapons mm-hmm. in production over here in Sweden, and I think that's what he's interested in. And I think it's not nice, and it's not something to be proud of. But I think that's probably where it's going to end, if I were to guess.
Okay, and this so, again so is yeah,
it's been a busy spring for us over here,
right? And this is just
about that.
Right, this is just one element of what's happening. And again, I want to stress that I've always thought of Sweden as a sort of non-combative nation. They are not the ones that automatically react, seem to take on a posture of hostility right away. You know, like, look, some Americans are ignorant enough to think Sweden and Switzerland must be the same thing. But truth is that, you know, Switzerland, by its geographical location, sort of needs to maintain neutrality if it wants to exist, and has historically done so. Sweden, on the other hand, a little different, and people don't think of the Swedish weaponry as something of significance. It doesn't make the headlines, Glenn. You know, it's not actively in use everywhere, like, you know, American weapons of war.
That's true. That's you know, true.
So
we do have actually one of our most sophisticated weapons mm-hmm. has been delivered to Ukraine, mm-hmm. which is the Enlaw. You know, it's one of these tank destroying weapons that you can have above your shoulder. It's
right.
very very efficient. I know that one has been sold to them, and I think they've gotten a couple of deliverances of that.
Right.
But they want more, obviously, and I know that the U.S. has been delivering lots of weapons to them,
right?
And the British guys also. So they're in desperate need, as I understand it.
Yes. But it's interesting to me in that I would not have thought first of Sweden looking to even join the NATO alliance. You know, again, we know about the interesting history with Turkey. Turkey's been on the ins, been on the outs, okay, with NATO, with the circumstances. Erdogan is problematic all by himself, but the nation and its behavior has been taken, well, interpreted in different ways by different powers that be. I'm trying to be gentle about this, Glenn. You understand?
Yeah, sure.
And they are certainly not a country that is unfamiliar with various hostilities. You know, you could see them needing military alliances and maybe even shifting alliances often. But what exactly, I mean, is it just the conflict in Ukraine that provoked this with Sweden, in your opinion, or is there more to it?
You mean the thing about Turkey, you mean?
Well, no. Not about NATO. Turkey. I'm saying Sweden looking to join NATO. Is it just based on the recent events in Ukraine, or is there a longer history that I do not know about where this might have been percolating a while among the, you know, in the Swedish government or among Swedish diplomats or even in the psyche of the people, like, you know, maybe we need to join up here and be a part of this military side of things. Is this something that's been there a while, or is it a new circumstance?
No. Yeah. Well, we've been a divided country for a long, long time, for decades. Mm-hmm. You know, the right-wing parties, all of them, two or three of them, they've been wanting to join NATO for decades, but
okay.
The party on the left side have not. So there's been this line, you know, for a long, long, long time, and never really a majority before to join. But you're absolutely right. The war in Ukraine changed everything.
I see.
Very, very quickly. Yeah. And, you know, if you look at it, it's not that far from Sweden. I mean, if you read about this war over here in the papers and so forth, or look at the news and stuff, what they're all saying is that now we do have a war, you know, among our neighbors.
Right.
That's the language we're using for this. You know, we are all Europeans, and we of course, we regard the Ukrainians as Europeans as well.
Right.
And so, you know, the way that the whole of Europe has come to the same conclusion about this is actually amazing. Mm-hmm. We've not seen anything like this in Europe for many decades. We're absolutely on the same side, all of us in Europe. Mm-hmm. And that I can't even remember anything where that has been as strong as it is right now about Ukraine. It's astonishing, really. But as far as Sweden, yeah, that was it. When this happened, the debate started immediately. You know, the 25th of February, basically the day after the war started.
Yeah, well, we're on about day 100 now of the active conflict. So, although I would argue that this invasion really began in 2014, but you know, technically speaking, the active daily shooting, so to speak, really started about 100 days ago. So we're one third of the way, almost through a year.
I would agree with that estimation. Yeah.
So, but either way, it's just an interesting thing to watch happen because our mainstream media has certainly reported it this way, and I've often found that they report things based on an agenda and do not necessarily tell us about what the will of the people was in certain places. But it does appear as though not only have the European governments sort of unified here, but the public appears to have unified in Europe regarding this. I mean, what I'm seeing as far as, again, they're not reporting it so much in America, but I go to foreign news services and I do see that there are public displays and demonstrations in various parts of Europe in support of usually the Ukrainians. But really more actively involved in this conflict than they have been in a lot of just slightly adjacent to the European Union conflicts in the past. So it does appear as though this is different from other circumstances previous. Yeah.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct about that. It's been very different. I mean, not slightly different. This is on a different scale, the unity of the rest of Europe. It's amazing, really.
Well, again, I'm giving you
the bottom right. line for that is, mm-hmm. is simply that, you know, we can't accept that a dictatorship, Russian style, right. does this thing to a young democracy, which is how you should, I think, define Ukraine of today. Mm-hmm. They're doing their best to become a democratic country, and everyone in Europe thinks of this problem this way, I think.
Right. Well, look, they have been attempting to assert their independence for quite a long time. I mean, you have a constitution which is in existence in Ukraine that they attempted to enact a longer time period ago than the one we have in America. You have the conflict which went back and forth. Sure, they were part of the Soviet Union at one point, but were they always the willing participant? That is another question. They do have a separate culture. A lot of Americans think it's just Russian culture. It is not. No. So, you know, there is a lot to this here. And it's just fascinating to me, though, that Europeans in general have this sort of, again, unified shift. And look, I said it's slightly different because that's what I can observe. It doesn't mean...
But you're right. The description that is often used, and I think it's probably a lot to it, is that Russia and Ukraine are brotherly countries. That's how they've been regarded over right. the past 30 years. They do know that they are close in many respects, you know, and many Russians obviously live also in Ukraine. I don't know exactly the number, but and also Ukrainians living in Russia before this war. Mm. So they are close in many respects. But on the other hand, you can say that after what happened back in 1989, you know, when they've signed a number of treaties, including Putin has signed a number of treaties establishing Ukraine as an independent country that can decide their own fate, basically. And that's what he has now violated by doing this invasion to the Ukrainians. So, I don't think it's all that, but you're right. You can say that this started back in 2014 when they took back Krim, you know, the island of Crimea.
Right.
But still, and that was not, everybody know that it was Khrushchev, you know, the old Soviet leader back in the 60s who gave basically the Crimea back to Ukraine. at that point, and there was no discussions at all about that. Nothing. And I'm not all that familiar with the exact problems about the whole discussion about Crimea. I'm no expert in this, but it came very sudden what right. Putin does, and I think that's the troubling thing. You know, if Putin were to be allowed to do this, you know, is this where he's going to end? And that's what everybody's afraid of, you know. And well, especially maybe Moldavia, the next country to a close neighbor to Ukraine. And also, of course, Finland, you know. They've got a long border with Russia, and they've had that for a long, long time now.
Right.
So, of course, you know, what's this guy up to with all these wars and these invasions? And, you know, it's scary stuff.
Well, that's
you know,
a key.
They do have
believe it or not, that's a key thing I want to get to here. And you're already hinting at it, so I'm going to ask it, and then I want to move on after that to the economic situation because again, you know, U.S. economists I think are rolling dice and throwing darts blindfolded here. So I'll ask you about what it looks like from where you're sitting, and that happens to be the thing that you're actually educated in. So that would be that's going to give us an interesting window. So hold on to that for a second, though, because the final question I have for you is about the justification and what it looks like. Now, look, I took a lot of flack for saying that this could look very much like what was experienced, and this should be more personal to the people of Europe than anywhere, regarding what Germany did in World War II. And, you know, look, it's not as fast moving. It's not as efficient. It's not as. But one would say that, you know, this could be reminiscent of at least the textbook version of what happened in World War II, previous to it being declared World War II. So we have been dealing with this in the U.S. media, where they're talking about the possibility of World War III, nuclear weapons, proliferation, the exchanges. Okay, well, that's the U.S. position, and sometimes that gets hyperbolic and ridiculous, honestly. You're sitting closer to it, and I'm sure that Europeans have to be viewing this differently than we are over here, no matter any way you slice it, because, first of all, as you mentioned, it's in your backyard, effectively. I mean, geographically, it's close. Okay, and also, you know, based on history, that sometimes when people decide to make moves in that area of the world, they might not stop, whether it's the Romans, the Russians, okay, the Germans. This is just history. So my question overall is, what are your thoughts on the justification that, you know, that Ukraine needed to be denazified? And, you know, because this is the thing. It's not about, well, I didn't invade a sovereign nation. I'm defending Russians who were in an area that should be declared independent. And I'm just curious how the Europeans have interpreted that. Because outside of our friends there in, you know, the Brexit, Great Britain, at this point, right? Great Britain doesn't exist. United Kingdom, sorry. You know, outside of our friends there, we're not getting a lot of word on what the rest of Europe thinks about this. And I think it's kind of important. You know, I mean, yes, we heard about Germany. We've heard about, well, there's the gas issue. There's the power issue. You know, how much energy is being distributed via Russia to various parts of Europe, on and on and on. We hear about the business. But, you know, what about the historical resonance? I mean, is this one of those things where, indeed, you started to say, is this where it ends? Well, you might have that suspicion based on, I don't know, history, you know, being
frankly, based on what Putin himself has said, you know. I listened the other day to an interview that BBC did with their old prime minister, Tony Blair, you know, who met, you know, something like 25, 30 times with Putin in the beginning of the 2000s. Now, he had a very interesting story to tell, and he said he was flabbergasted, basically, by Putin's sort of development over the past maybe 10 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
Because he said, when I met him in the beginning of 2000 and onwards, of a few years, his opinion was that absolutely he thought that what Putin back then wanted to create was a much more democratic style society in Russia. And there were still signs of that during Putin, I'd say, perhaps on to 2007 or somewhere there. that started to change. And I mean, since then, it's been a downhill slope ever since. You know, with him, they don't have free press. They don't have a free judicial or separated judicial from government. It's all one and the same. And all these, you've seen it now since the war started. You know, it's totally crazy. You can get 15 years just for going down and protesting on a square somewhere. Right. It's totally dictatorship. No, but the interesting question, you mentioned that. You know, I think most people think that the views of Russia as presented by Putin is that he has gotten back all these dreams of an empire, the old empire. He's talking in terms of an empire, and that's the crazy thing, you know. Of course people are going to think that, is he hinting about the old Soviet Union? You know, how many more countries are at risk from Russia today? So if that's the discussion you've had in the U.S., well, I'd say that's pretty much the same discussion we're having over here in Europe, okay. Even though, of course, we're closer, and by definition, perhaps also takes this a little bit more serious, because it's sort of a more direct threat to us over here.
Well, right.
Obviously, than the U.S. can see it. But right. it's a different. I mean, that's the. I'd say that that's probably the main opinion is this empire dreams. Yeah. But you know, there are others as well. You know, they're looking at it historically, and some people think he's just downright crazy, and you know, there are all kinds of views on the reasons for Putin doing this. So it's a difficult question, but one thing that was interesting was that I noticed that Kissinger, you know, the old Secretary of State in the U.S. had the same opinion now as this what's his name, the very old left guy. I think you know who I mean. He's 95 or something now. They never think the same about anything,
right.
But they did have the same opinion about this one, namely start negotiate, and you're going to have to give some of Eastern Ukraine to the Russians. Mm. Those two guys agreed on that. That was quite interesting.
Well, the second Kissinger says anything, I get nervous because this guy. anyway, no, and it is weird.
Yeah, but you see, Kissinger. I mean, you can't call him a leftist guy. But
no.
You know who I mean. I can't remember his name now. It's an old, very famous leftist guy in the U.S.
Well, there's quite a few of them that he's now agreeing with in his statements.
Yeah, but he's the old maestro, I'd say.
You're talking about the historian Chomsky, maybe?
Chomsky, that's right. Exactly.
Okay.
I mean, how many times historically has those two guys
almost
been
never
having the same opinion about something as important as this?
Yeah, almost.
Probably never.
Almost never until after the fact, and long after the fact they might start to agree. But otherwise, when things are actually happening, forget it. I get your point, and it is, look, it's just what is happening at the moment. And I got to say that it has sort of fallen out of favor with the headlines here in the U.S. because we have our own concerns domestically. Today, another interesting event and a press conference breaking down this, you know, shooting at a hospital and all this. Look, there's a lot of things going on over here. But the one thing that's going on worldwide that I wanted to make sure I addressed with you before we were done again, and I want to give you some time on this because, frankly, all I can see from what is publicly observable and the way that business is being conducted here in the U.S. is that the greater corporate entities have decided that it is, time to make a withdrawal on all of us. They're profiting mightily. They're doing quite well. Doesn't matter if you're running out of baby formula or you can't afford your gasoline. They don't give a crap. They're making record profits, okay? And that's what I see. The game in Wall Street really should be up because everybody should understand that the jig is up. This is a game, and it doesn't represent the real world at all, okay? The housing market is doing some weird twists and turns again, okay? And in the meantime, it's the majority of us that are trying to figure out why a tomato is $5, okay? which it was not too long ago, even during the pandemic and the shortages that were even more prevalent than they are now, right? Okay, yeah. So is it cause or effect with the greater corporate entities in the U.S.? All right, it's hard to judge, okay? Because
it's hard. No, but the problem this time, which is different. I mean, obviously, inflation is the big problem in the U.S. and it's still on the rise here. I think we've seen the top perhaps in the U.S. now. That's a possibility. It had gone down a little bit. I seem to remember. But in Europe and in Sweden, it's going up, still going up. I mean, Germany reported a couple of days ago, 7 point something. This is dangerous stuff, very dangerous, because now it looks like, there might be a possibility going back to the evil circle of the 70s, when salaries are going to have to go up. All organizations, unions, and so forth are gonna work very hard now to have salaries going up, and that might then trigger the cycle of continued long time inflation,
right?
Just the way we saw it back in the 70s. I hope it won't happen. I hope we're smarter than that now, because we saw the problems with such a thing back in the 70s, and we haven't seen it since. But this, I mean, this is something, it's happened only in about 3 months as well, it's just exploded, and that's dangerous stuff. And of course, both in the U.S. and in Europe and in Sweden, those who have to take the heaviest burden, of course, are those with the lowest wages.
Right.
They are, so inflation is a very sort of, ruthless thing. For everyone, but especially poor people.
Well, and that's
lower income.
Yeah, that is okay. Now, I still point to what is the major problem. Okay, the major problem is that ever since the 70s, you would have thought some lessons were learned, but salaries should have rose along with the sort of normal progression of inflation in this country. They did not. They were never commensurate with the rise of the cost of living. And I know that they never really are. There's always a bit of a delay and this and that in a healthy economy, even. But I think for far too long, there was a suppression in the wages, as I pointed out many times. I mean, if you're to get to the level of a living standard, okay, I use the minimum wage. I know the minimum wage is not the minimum wage. I don't want to get into that argument because, in the U.S., like, well, who actually gets paid the minimum wage? Yeah, I know, but there is a minimum floor on this, and they do maintain that minimum floor, and they do enforce it across the board while things are going up. And what happened is it became so great of a distance between the real cost of living increase and the actual increase of the majority of wages paid that, honestly, around the time I was born, if you were to get to just where it was in 1970-72, you're looking at $25 an hour, which, people would say today is insane.
I think we've talked about this, or I've talked about it a little bit before on your show. Mm-hmm. That, if you look at the income distribution in the U.S. as compared to most Western European countries, it's very, it's very different.
Lopsided is what it is.
In the U.S., yeah, it is. I just saw some numbers the other day, actually. 1% of the U.S. wealth is distributed to the top 1%. And now the next third is distributed to the next 9%, which means that 90% is splitting on the last third of all wealth in the U.S.
Right.
Now, these are numbers, that you don't see in Europe. I can tell you that. And that's a huge difference between the U.S. and Europe and most countries in Europe, at least the old Western countries in Europe, how the wealth is distributed. So of course it's going to hit something, and also if you take, for instance, the energy prices. I mean, I do remember. I have lived in the U.S. and we were all surprised when we moved over there how cheap petrol was, and it's still that way. I mean, you're talking about $5 a gallon now, I believe. Or along those lines, and do you know what it is here in Sweden? It's It's, well, a gallon, let's see now, that's 4 liters. Well, that's, in Sweden, that would be, we pay 24 crowns per liter, so that's 90 kroners, which is $9 for a gallon, approximately. So that's twice the price that you have.
Right, I was just actually going to go take a look at what a gallon is in liters. I always forget this, but I think it's actually, let's see, yeah, it is. It's 3 1/4. So 3 1/4, 3 3/4, about 3.78 liters to the gallon. So,
yeah,
how much is it per liter?
It's here in Sweden now. I think today we had something like 24 kronas, which is almost $2.50. For 1 liter, and you have almost 4 liters to a gallon, I believe.
Right. So
so it's twice as expensive over here.
Yeah. Okay. No. Fair enough. It is twice.
Of course, this is gonna hit anyone who has work. You know, for instance, that who needs to go to work and drive something. This is gonna hit them hard.
Right.
Over here as well. You know. So there's been a lot of discussion about it. You know, to lower the taxes. We have high petrol taxes here in Sweden. Environmental taxes and VAT, both of them we have on this, it's the taxes. But you know, the taxes have not created this. The market has created this because of shortcomings, basically, in supply. That's why, and worries. But you're absolutely right. What you started with, you know, the petrol companies are obviously doing ridiculous profits right now as we speak.
Right.
And as it looks, as I've been looking at these things lately a little bit more intensely, and you know, I wonder how long this is going to go on. As it looks today, we're probably going to see the same high energy prices for the rest of this year, and even possibly a bit higher than they are right now. So this is going to hit us very, very hard.
Yeah,
and,
it's a guarantee that it's going to continue, especially because, and I argue, by the way, that due to the fact that speculators and the people dealing in commodities drove the price in a certain direction. I mean, it's not that long ago we actually saw the metric break regarding oil. You know, it was at a negative price point, right, for a little bit in the U.S., and that is totally bizarre. I think that between that and a bunch of money that was lost by the fuel companies during that time when, guess what, a lot of the country was on lockdown, okay, you weren't getting the same kind of dollars pouring into the Exxons, the BPs, the Shells, all of that across the country. You certainly weren't getting it on the retail level at all because people weren't traveling. And a lot of jobs were suspended and, you know, turned over to Zoom, so now people were Zooming to their jobs instead of driving. I'm just saying, this is one of the realities that took hold. I think they took a massive loss during that time. And one thing I do know about these kinds of companies, certainly, having worked for one of them, is that, they don't take losses like this without having plans to recoup them. Okay, this is what, you know, again, ExxonMobil, right? And it was just Exxon when I started with them, but they... ended up buying Mobil, and then we're told by the U.S. government they were too large. That was a whole weird fiasco, too. But either way, that company absolutely had a circumstance where they were not going to let this bad price point and these other things go by without answering it. And I knew that from watching them and actually being a stockholder on their behalf and everything else. Every time there was a dip in the market, there was a problem, and it didn't matter if it was the PR disaster of the Exxon Valdez, okay, or the bad publicity that came out, you know, regarding them joining up with Mobil and being too big now, dominating the market, this and that, and people always think of this on the retail level, but there was a far greater reaching consequences to that merger, but anyway, it didn't matter. They always had a plan to recover from any of the negative impacts that the market had for them. And September 11th was another situation where there was a massive spike. And frankly, the war on terror became another time period where You know, up until that point, okay, and this is the thing. Oil at $50 a barrel was not unrealistic, and still it was a dollar a gallon at the pump. So it's not a matter of just inflation, right? There were other forces in play here that kept it like that so that there was still profit to be made, even with the taxes, okay? Because you're talking a dollar, and a third of that was going to tax in the U.S., depending on where you were. Anyway. That's how cheap it was.
There's a lot to what you're saying, yeah, and I do agree. I mean, these guys are sophisticated businessmen. There's no question about that. All these big companies, the oil giants, all of them, you know, both in U.S. and elsewhere. But you know, the basic problem this time around has been various supply problems, mm-hmm. and supply chain problems. Both of those problems has had a strong impact this time around, and that's nothing that you can't blame that on the oil companies. There are other things you might be able to blame them for, but not this particular issue with supply chain problems and supply problems. Now remember, we're taking out as best we can Russia as much as possible. We're taking them away from the market now in Western Europe, and that changes obviously how much oil there's going to be available, you know, because for instance the Saudis don't want to raise their production. They've been asked to do it, and so far they haven't. Mm-hmm. Just as an example, and that's a problem. Of course it is, and there's more to it, because now all of these sanctions and the last package of sanctions that came, I think, only two or three days ago from the European Union tells us that everyone is going to get out of oil within a year. Uh-huh. And that's, you know, that's a huge change in oil supply. So, of course, and if you have that in the bottom of everything else that we now have with the war and the supply problems around the world, with these big oil tankers, you know, being able to go into harbor and get their oil off their ships, mm-hmm. and stuff like that. I have a friend who is very much into shipping, and he's been telling me about all kinds of problems in that industry, mm-hmm. with the oil tankers. So there's a lot. It's a complicated. If we're talking just oil and energy, it's quite a complex situation right now.
Well,
we were already in problems because of the pandemic situation we had for a couple
right.
of years before this war started.
Well, see, that's where I wanted to.
At best, we're on our way out of this pandemic situation. Then comes this war instead, you know, and sort of, well, twists everything around once again.
Yeah, but see, that's where I find it more complicated than most economists are willing to look at. And you just said the key thing that they're not ever wanting to admit to, which is this. As I said, 100 days now, the conflict, right? Let's just assume that there was another 50 days or so, okay, where people were worried about the coming conflict and these things impacted stuff like the fuel price, right? Okay, if I even grant that is an impact that would cause what we're looking at today, here's the problem. We were already on track for this before that. And it is due to partially the pandemic, okay? Because as I said, they lost money due to a lack of volume in their business. I mean, it's just, you know, it's you can't get around that. So one would say that that's part of the equation, but it just seems to me as though there's something else going on here. Because at all points, the pressure still goes upward and we don't get relief. Now, there was a couple of things that happened here that you thought would have slowed it down, and some people argue that it did slow it down in the U.S., right? And that is the release of some strategic reserves. That happened, okay? And in the U.S., there has been suspension of taxes on the state level in some states. Some of them were temporary. Some of them are still in place. And nothing, to my knowledge, has slowed it down. Now, regionally, there are differences, and some people go, well, why is it regionally different here or there? Look, you got to understand the differences in distribution in order to understand that, because I can tell you, having worked in that business, there's a big difference between delivering it from a place where it is stored, and it's, you know, less of a distance to run it by truck or by rail or whatever, to from one place to another, or if you have to actually get it from a ship to a refinery, you know, all those costs are going to get passed along. So this is why we have regional differences. There are different other things that go on, including pipelines and other elements to the distribution that nobody thinks of before it gets to your gas pump, okay? So I know why we have gradient differences in different parts of the country, but still, it prevails.
Yeah, yeah, no, everywhere. But I think it's you know, I do agree with you. I mean, these are very, very professional businessmen. These big oil companies. There's no question about that. And I do think, however, that you know, there's a bit of a difference between your view on this and mine. Where I think, sorry to say, Chuck, you're a bit more into this you have, is it penchant the right word in English?
Could be.
For loading a little bit too much on them, I think.
Okay.
You know, it's kind of hard to see what is what as well. I mean, sometimes you can see obvious problems. I mean, when you read, as I did a few months back, about drilling companies in Texas closing down different holes, you know, mm-hmm. because they wanted to have the price go up. I mean, that's an obvious thing. These were not the big ones. These were a few smaller companies. You know, they closed some holes because they said, no, this is too low, when the price was at about $60, I believe.
Right.
Between $50 or $60. No, we're not going to sell it to this price. You know, we're closing business with those holes, and we're going back into the market again once the price goes up. Mm-hmm. So that's an obvious reason. But I think, you know, it isn't all that easy to see. And also, you should know, as I'm sure you do, oil companies, they're making money even at $60. The big ones, the right. giants, they are making money anyway, because when you have that low oil price, you also have lower prices all along the supply chain, you know. So right. they are, I mean, their business model is sort of guaranteeing them quite substantial profits no matter what.
Right.
That's how this market works, I should say.
Yes.
I would say.
Yeah, no, you're look.
Now I did.
No, you're right. And look, I do have a tendency to load it on them because, again, I see the significance of their actions. They take what, you know, and most people don't take notice of the stuff you're talking about. Another significant factor, obviously, is what you mentioned regarding the Saudis and their unwillingness to raise production. You know, yeah. I've heard rumor about that possibly the Saudis don't want to do it because, you know, as much as people think it's an endless supply there in Saudi Arabia, they might be coming to the end of that cycle, in which case they're going to have to reimagine everything as far as their own economies go if all of a sudden oil is not exactly the centerpiece it once was. And I am certainly not in the know about any of that stuff.
Yeah, sure. It's not an endless resource. Absolutely not.
Yeah,
but you know, they don't have to worry for. I haven't seen the numbers lately, but you know, there's still plenty of oil.
Yeah, no, there's still plenty there. But if they don't necessarily have the same amount coming out of the fields they once did, they could be starting to think about, well, what else can we do with our economies?
Yeah, and I think there has been at various occasions, basically, mm-hmm. when the government of Saudi has actually closed holes and stopped some pumping up of oil mm-hmm. because they think that there's too much oil on the market,
right?
And the price is too low. I mean, many of those who are expert on the oil markets have claimed this many times before, you know.
Right.
It hasn't been for that long, as far as I know, but it has happened.
Yeah.
And they haven't had, as far as I've understood it, they haven't had any good explanations for doing that. So,
right.
So you know, even a government can do, what the big oil companies can do all by themselves.
Of course. But you see, but that's the thing. It's not merely one metric. And
no.
The people that claim that, you know, the whole reason why the oil price is the way it is Ukraine, I think it's silly. Now, it's not the whole of the reason. Is it having an impact? I guess, you know, that makes some sense. But then again, I think it's the worry about maybe being invested in some of the process with Russia and what will happen next regarding how they're going to be able to market. Are they going to be limited? I mean, are they just going to have to sell to the Chinese at some point if enough sanctions come into play? You know, this concept about, well, now we'll take the money in rubles as opposed to dollars. All of this these are factors. Are they ultimately what's?
But also, you know, we've talked quite a bit about the oil companies and the energy market. But you know, the main problem today, the main problem without question, is the inflation. This is a huge problem,
right now.
And I just thought, well, you know, that's the main problem we have, because if people's, and I'm talking about, you know, private citizens, I'm talking about companies, I'm talking about governments, if their expectation is staying at levels this high of future inflation, then we have a big problem worldwide with inflation. I hope that doesn't happen, because if it does, we haven't learned from history at all about how dangerous it is, because inflation rates at these numbers is extremely dangerous. You know, it can cause basically, you know, all kinds of markets collapsing, actually. Especially, you know, when you have anything here in Sweden now, house pricing are going down. It has just started going down. It's not that bad, but they're talking. Okay. I read one article today. They're saying, well, 15-20% down is quite a possibility right now. And when that happens, always, as we remember from 2007 and 2008, when you have problems in the housing market, that's when the banks are in danger as well. And that's a reason. Then we're talking serious business, really. You know, when the banks are starting having problems from the housing markets.
Well, right. But based on the past, though, and here's the ultimate question here at the end. Based on what we know from the past and the way things have gone, right, we know that there are inflationary curves that occur, and sometimes through painful actions, you know, not necessarily intentional, but painful things occur. And we have a reset of sorts where, look, the inflation will come down, or there will be an equilibrium somehow developed between, you know, what people are able to earn and what they're able to, you know, what their purchasing power is again. At some point, it will come together a little more, because it'll have to lay off either through collapse or through some kind of relief. You've already said that for the rest of this year, don't expect any relief. But I mean, do you think this is going to be a bust situation where we're going to have to see a collapse in one of the major sectors of the really the global economy, you know, before we get relief? Or is there going to be some way to, you know, to alleviate the pressure on, I don't know, most of us existing here in this matrix of money? I mean, because one way or another, it's going to come to an end. But is it going to come to an end painfully, or is it going to be, you know, incrementally sort of relieved?
I don't know. As I said, you know, what many forget is that expectations is a big factor in this. It's when expectations of inflation change, that's the danger, you know. When everybody is expecting high inflation, they're taking action to defend themselves against that, and that's when we're back in that circle, or at risk of coming back to that 70 circle of high inflation, with all bad things that would mean. And we're not there yet, and I'm not saying you know, this has to happen, but this is a big problem. I mean, now we have the immediate problem of everything getting so expensive. I mean, food is getting expensive, energy is getting expensive, and lots of other things as well. Right. And as you're in, and to this I agree, in various industries and in various branches of the economy, some people don't have to raise the prices as much as they have.
Right.
But they're sort of, you know, they're grabbing the opportunity right now. Right. More than anything, so some of them have actually been criticized for this and gone back to lower those prices, and I'm talking also down on the street level, basically, you know, one shop there and one shop here. Well, everybody else is raising the prices, so why shouldn't I? Even though their basic prices they're paying for the merchandise has not been raised that much, so there are many bad things that can be built into a situation like this, and they're quite, and obviously I do agree with those who think that the Federal Reserve and the we have the equivalent here in Sweden, Riksbanken, they have been asleep at the wheel. That's
for a while.
I don't think that's too much of an exaggeration, actually,
right.
Because it's they're taken asleep, it looks like.
Well, for a long time, they seem to be taking action or allowing action to stand that they should have been taking at a time when the economy was doing poorly. When it was doing well, they were doing the same thing. And now the threat of even the raise in rates from the Fed here is almost seen as like catastrophic by people going, well, if they raise it 0.75 point, if that's the interest rate goes up, you're going to see disastrous stuff. And they're signaling, listen, we got to at least do that. I mean, there is no way to slow this down unless we increase the, it's almost too much where it's like, yeah, I think they were asleep at the switch for a bit, because had they introduced the rate increases earlier, we might not be in this circumstance. Now, some people say it's the stimulus money, and, you know, various countries distributed stimulus money during the pandemic situation with the lockdowns. I don't necessarily disagree with them entirely, but I don't think it's the key thing here. I think it's the idea that somebody was running a reverse program. Normally, there would have been actions taken by the centralized banks that would have slowed down this inflation a bit, because it would have, not made the housing market skyrocket if you had a higher interest rate, okay? And when the housing market skyrockets, especially among people who are renters and things, this starts to become extremely painful. That's happened all over the country now because of this price spike in real estate.
If you go back a year from only a year, I do remember listening to Federal Reserve. You know, he was having this speech about rates and stuff. And one problem with rates is that when you have supply chain problems, as we had, you know, 1 year and 2 years back, that's something. It's very difficult through rates to adjust that, because that's got nothing to do with the flow of money, basically. Mm-hmm. So it's a different type, and it was a very complex and complicated supply chain we had this time. That's, I think, most economists are agreeing about this. Right. It was difficult to really point out one thing. It was a whole array of different supply chain problems that arise during the pandemic,
right?
And that was, I think, new to most Federal Reserve and other Riksbanks, you know, around the world. This was a new type of problem that we hadn't seen for a very, very long time.
True.
In the scale that it occurred this time. And I think that might have been something to do with the fact that they didn't react in time. And then on top of everything else, we have this war, which in that situation couldn't have come at a worse time, basically. So it was, I'm not saying it was easy for them, but obviously here we are today, you know, with every bank in the world are telling us now we're going to raise rates, and we're going to have to do it quite substantially.
Oh, sure.
Over the next year, maybe 2 or 3 years.
Even. Yeah. My ultimate point is, though, that there is a ripple effect when you don't. When you start to see the prices spike in the housing market and there is not an increase in interest rates, it means that it can go a little too far, a little too fast, and I think that happened. And now housing, which is a major...
That was back in 2008. So that was for a whole different reason. The financial industry had been throwing money away for many years in the
U.S. Yeah. But what I'm saying is right now, we had a housing increase here during a time when, again, nobody was making more money, and I think if the Fed had stepped up and added to the interest rate, even by a quarter point, it would have slowed it down a bit. And that became a point of impact on the economy because, again, you know, everybody forgets this. They talk about the grocery store. They talk about the gas pump. But, you know, our housing cost is pretty major. Okay.
Yeah,
the thing to keep your roof over your head is a significant price point that you got to deal with. Everybody's got to keep a roof over their head. So either they've made a purchase, they're paying a tax, or they are renting or still in the process of paying off a loan. So, you know, housing is a constant cost and pretty significant and fairly universal. So
absolutely,
when that's affected, and again, if the Fed wanted to responsibly slow that spike down, it would have been a good time to introduce an interest rate increase. Okay, which would have stopped some people from selling their properties at high profits, because now they would have had to, add into the total cost an increase in interest. okay? Especially if they're buying it with a mortgage. So that's all I'm saying for now. We don't have a housing crash, but I think they could have taken action to prevent that thing, which made a ripple in the economy. Again, I'm not an economist, and I certainly never claim to understand money all that well. But I live in the world, Glenn, and sadly we're out of time.
I think you're pretty good at it.
Thank you. But, you know, sadly we're out of time. I'm going to give you guys the link to Glenn's blog, and one of the most interesting things that he's put out there is related to the JFK case. And even though him and I might see that differently, we certainly see one of the things he's blogged about quite a bit exactly the same. So I'm going to give you guys that link. And Glenn, I thank you for taking this hour with me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Chuck. Bye-bye.
So Glenn Vikeland, and yeah, I appreciate this guy. And listen, we don't necessarily have to see eye to eye. I want to learn, and I hope you guys learned something from Glenn here in this first hour. In the next hour, author Joseph L. Flatley will be with me, and we'll talk about the failed state update. Anyway, the Ocelli Effect continues after this.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough.
Maybe you're thinking about getting started.
WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
Go there now.
Go there now.
The War State by Michael Swanson explains the great national transformation that took place and put the Kennedy presidency in the context of the times and reveals never-before-published information about the Cuban Missile Crisis. President Kennedy would not have been assassinated if he had been president 200 years ago. His assassination took place in the context of the Cold War and the rise of the national security state. Before World War II, the United States was a continental republic. In the decade that followed, it became an imperial superpower. Generals such as Curtis LeMay not only wanted to invade Cuba, but knew that there were short-range missiles on the island armed with nuclear warheads that they could not destroy because they were on mobile launchers. Their invasion could have led to a third world war, and they wanted to go to war anyway. The War State by Michael Swanson reveals why and will show you what President Kennedy was up against. For more information, thewarstate.com.
Revelation through conversation. Revelation through conversation.
Ocelli.com.
Get ready for the Ocelli Effect.
Second hour of the Ocelli Effect begins now at Ocelli.com, but of course, you could be hearing us some other time, some other place, and you're equally welcome to it. So, Thor's Day, what do we got? Well, every other week, we get the failed state update. Okay, and I keep trying to get the duo of the co-hosts there at the failed state update to come on, and sometimes I get Joseph L. Flatley by himself, like we did 2 weeks ago, but this time I've actually got both of them. J.G. Michael, who is also responsible for one of the best podcasts out there, in you know, not to say that the failed state update isn't cool, but Parallax Views, okay, which a funny thing happened this week, actually. I just want to tell you really quick, JG, is that a guy who was totally unfamiliar with decided to send me a message that I really needed to listen to your podcast.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was like, you want to hear about this because what happened is I went on Ricky Verandez's Ripple Effect, and you know, I kind of got, yeah, Ricky wanted to get personal, so I got personal, and I went on there and talked about a few things, and there was a quick exchange between him and I about, you know, Russia and Ukraine, and Ricky and I do not see eye to eye on that, but the exchange was sort of lukewarm. It wasn't a big deal, I thought, and a couple of people caught that and went, oh, you don't realize that he has on people like this, and you know what you need to do is listen to J.G. Michael's podcast about this guy, because, you know, this guy, J.G. Michael, is actually really good. You should listen to him. And I was like, okay, he's been on my show a lot of times, and actually has helped me book guests and things like this. And if you go back in his archive, I think there's even a show or two with me on it. But anyway, I thought that was funny and fun. But anyway, you know, you're responsible for that. But the two of you together work on the failed state update. And, of course, Joseph L. Flatley is an author in his own right. J.G. Michael writes articles constantly about all kinds of different social political topics, mainly politics, even though I don't think you think of yourself sometimes as a political writer. You definitely cover an interesting part of the spectrum. Anyway, so with all that in mind, welcome to the show, guys. And where should I start? Well, let's begin with what's been going on lately with the failed state update, and let's get an update. Joseph L. Flatley, what's been going on over there?
Good question. You know, it's like the thing with being a one-man band is, you know, I think I'm talking to two one-man bands right here, is that... something happens, like the wheel stud on your car breaks, and then you don't do anything for 2 days because you're running around, you know, trying to get the $7 part. So it's like, so most of this week I've been writing kind of a longer feature. Two books came out recently, and I'm going to totally blank on the author's names, but the titles are The Rise and Fall of the Neoliberal Order and The Rise of Ecofascism. And I thought it was really interesting that those two books came out at the same time. And I definitely see, you know, they overlap on the Venn diagram, you know, The Rise of Ecofascism being probably attributable to the, you know, neoliberal order failing miserably, and meaning, because neoliberal is a loud, ugly, long word. All we're saying is like this rush to make everything free market healthcare, free market anything, any problem that we have will be handled by the free market. Any function of the government will be handed over to private businesses is failing. And as that fails, the world gets ugly and mean and weird, and, you know, far right wing extremists like, you know, eco-fascists, you know, could potentially be on the rise. So that's where my head's been at, thinking about that, thinking about Ron DeSantis, who, you know, you want to see where these guys would like the United States to head, you know, which direction they would like it to go into. Look at Florida. It's just such a weird don't say gay bill, stop woke anti-CRT bill, sanctuary cities ban, you know, anything, any kind of weird political grandstanding that plays to the right-wing base, I think, is going to continue to be the normal for a while. If
I can attest to that as someone in Florida right now. My God, I feel like I've gone into a vortex.
Oh, really?
Oh, boy. Wait a minute. What? Well, all right, let's be specific, but not too specific. Are you in the northern part of Florida, the southern part of Florida?
Yeah, I'm like, oh. not the southern part, definitely. But
okay.
It's
there is a difference, by the way. Just it's Florida's not one thing. I just want
that is
to know
true. That is true.
So, yeah, go ahead.
No, just people are very politicized right now, I guess, and you know the whole groomer thing and DeSantis going on about that. I mean, I was at a gas station recently, just trying to buy like an energy drink and cigarettes because I had to stay up and do some work, and I don't know, the gas station attendant just starts talking to me about, I will not vote for anyone unless they know the libertarian economist, Thomas Sowell. Do you know who Thomas Sowell is? I'm like, this guy trying to figure out if I'm like, what my politics are? Is he like sizing me up? What, why? I just want my cigarettes, man. Like, he's being really aggressive about it. And I'm like, oh, I guess this is Florida.
Well, and of course, he picks the one guy that would walk in and probably know who that is.
Yeah, amazingly. But you know what? I in fairness, he's probably said it 15 times already that day. And generally speaking, just because I suffer from the same problem, it could be due to the fact that... Is your hair still long?
No, I've actually cut it. I've gone short now.
Okay, then I withdraw the point I was attempting to make. Because this happens to me going into places sometimes. The person behind the counter will suddenly do something, and I want to say that. All right, allow me to be racist for a minute. Black people don't do this to me. Just saying, okay. And but a white guy will see long hair on me and suddenly go into these conversations here in Georgia. So yeah, I just divided that on racial lines because it's the truth. The same guy might also turn around in that same conversation and ask me if I know about what the Mises Institute is, and then turn around and ask me if I think they should have gotten rid of the stars and bars from NASCAR because he's no longer going to support NASCAR because of it. I just want you to know that whole conversation could take place. And yeah, all I wanted was a pack of cigarettes and a Monster Recover. But you know. That happens to me too in Georgia, but I thought it was the long hair. Perhaps I'm wrong. No problem. Okay,
it could be that. So I don't know. I think people are like passive aggressive about politics in the part of Florida I'm at, where it's like you sort of have a lot of people that lean right wing, to put it mildly, and they're like trying to suss you out. And if they see long hair, you know, they may be thinking, who's this hippie kid?
Oh, yeah, it could be. But I'm not a kid, for sure. Nobody's going to mistake me for being young. You know, you still look young, not me. But anyway, back to your point, Flatley, because, you know, yeah, you're looking at DeSantis. I'm surprised you didn't want to bring up Abbott as far as state governors.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
You know.
I mean, there's so many people. And it's the governor's races. I mean, even better than Abbott and DeSantis, better in quotes, these, you know, pseudo QAnon gubernatorial candidates, like these people that first time in politics all over the country who are running, and really just the most far right wing, least credible, you know, make Tucker Carlson look reasonable in person. It's like that would be some good content, JG. We should do like a governor's roundup, race roundup or something.
You know what's been on my mind, actually? It's funny, since you mentioned the Mises Institute and we were talking about Thomas Sowell, there's a really crazy thing happening with the Libertarian Party now, and I'm thinking of doing some reporting on it. I don't know if you guys heard, but the Mises Caucus within the Libertarian Party has basically taken over the party now. And I guess they decided to take, like, you know, abortion rights off one of their planks. And it's causing an uproar now because the Mises Caucus sort of agrees with these people like Hans Hermann Hoppe, who is, like, a libertarian, but he's also, like, really anti-immigration. I don't want to say everyone in the Mises Caucus is like this because my friend Scott Horton, I think, is supportive of it from his sort of anti-war stance. But, yeah, things are getting really weird. And it seems like these sort of right-wing elements are kind of everywhere now, and pushing things further and further to the right. But I thought it was interesting that's happening with the Libertarian Party now as well as the Republican Party.
Well, Horton's a unique character anyway. He doesn't necessarily comply with anybody's prescription, all right? So
I like Scott a lot, so yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying I agree with the guy on a lot of things. I'm just saying that if you're going for, okay, if you agree with A and B, and that must mean you agree with C, don't do that with Scott Horton, because it doesn't necessarily follow anybody's program. You know, that I've learned about him over the years, and I'm not even his friend, I don't think. He's been on the show before, but I mean, I'm just saying, just my reading of his stuff, you cannot necessarily predict that he's going to follow anybody's entire line of reasoning. So, you know, he's different. I don't know what to make of what's happening, though, among those that do follow, you know, supposedly the libertarian mindset at this point. It's getting weird. And I think it's being even more consumed by the more right wing element. You know, the very same thing that kind of, in my estimation, hijacked the Tea Party, which had a different ideal to begin with, and then just became consumed by the right wing, where I don't think they were entirely right wing to begin with. Now, people disagree with me on that. I think there was actually a purity to the libertarian ideals that they started with, but that got taken over. And I think there might be a final move to really consume the rest of what's left of libertarian politicos out there and just make it part of the right wing entirely, even though it really should not have been entirely consumed by it. And you kick a couple of planks out of there, and I guess it's not that much different to the outside observer, you know?
It's weird with this whole Libertarian Party thing because, I mean, people like Scott that are sort of associated with the Mises Caucus, you know, I think they're actually better on anti-war stuff than a lot of other elements of the Libertarian Party. I think sometimes the Libertarian Party has shied away from that. But you also have these characters associated with the caucus, like comedian Dave Smith, who's been on Joe Rogan recently, that is like really into this like whole pro-life thing, and is like, oh, abortion is not actually like a libertarian position, or at least that's what my understanding of his views are.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, I didn't know. I always thought the abortion rights thing was pretty much, you know, a very libertarian position.
Well, because, you know, one second, though. I've always had this question about that, okay? And Joe, maybe you'll pick up on this, too. Because, okay, I hear these guys now saying, listen, it's about the rights of the being that cannot defend themselves. And this is the new sort of explanation. It's kind of recycled from the past where, you know, look, it's one-third of the argument, right? But... no, it's not one-third of the argument. Somewhere lost in there, though, among the libertarians, and they can't answer it, is, okay, look, let's assume you're right about this, and scientifically, whatever, whatever, whatever. Even though, again, if you have a heartbeat and no brain activity in a fully realized human being, they're not necessarily legally alive, okay? But anyway, let's go back to this. Where does the woman lose her agency in the equation? Because... that's the thing. You're giving primary concern to this other entity, and by default, that means that agency is lost by the woman. So I don't understand that, and I don't understand why a position is taken in a hardline sense by somebody who is claiming to be libertarian, because by circumstance, you're saying that the woman surrenders her agency. So I could never get, I don't know, I could never get the philosophical basis for this with the libertarian who is fully anti-abortion. I don't know. Maybe it's just me. But, Joe, you were going to say something else. I needed to throw that in. Sorry.
You know, I have no real interest in libertarianism at all. But
okay.
Except when I was, like, in high school and, you know, like, the town hippie was like, Republicans and Democrats are evil. You should be a libertarian. So, like, you know, when I turned 18, I registered to vote. I registered as a libertarian. And then I realized that they were all kind of D-bags, so I switched.
Yeah.
But, you know, Mark Ames and Yasha Levine over at The Exiled used to do really good reporting on these guys. And my understanding is that, like, if you kind of go back to the foundations of American, like, not libertarianism as a philosophy, but, you know, this kind of, like, think tank political structure that's been happening since, like, the 60s and 70s, mm-hmm. that the foundations of American libertarianism really aren't, like, you know, this philosophy as much as it's all a weird power grab for rich people. So, mm-hmm. like, the fact that, and I know, you know, I know a lot of libertarians that I think are well-meaning and, you know, intellectually honest and just have their opinions. Right. But I think the actual kind of institutional libertarianism we have in America, the kind of capital L libertarianism, has always been messed up anyways. So to see it kind of, you know, kind of melding with the Tea Party Republicans, that doesn't seem to be like a big departure for me.
Huh. Well,
yeah, I only brought it up because I find the sort of internecine sort of strife and conflict happening amongst the Libertarian Party proper to be an interesting development. Even though I don't think, you know, the Libertarian Party is like a big force. I think libertarianism actually has been a big force, both for good and ill in some ways. Mm. But it is interesting seeing a lot of the developments politically in the country at the moment. Things are just completely haywire.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, you want to talk about gubernatorial stuff coming up. I mean, we have this situation where, Purdue here in Georgia challenging Kemp, okay, who is, you know, to my mind, quite the standard GOP standard, and not a surprise here in Georgia. Still, unrealistically, they're going to run Stacey Abrams against him. But the weirder part of that is this whole, you know, Kemp and Purdue, and then Purdue gets the endorsement of Trump. I mean, that's a no-brainer there. Because of what happened. But I mean, this weirdness of being at cross purposes, and are they really at cross purposes, is a larger question. And there's always a difference between the larger entity that calls itself something. I mean, observe the big difference between sort of the standard corporate Democrat versus the rank and file of the Democratic Party over the past 10 years. I mean, I don't know where you're going to see an even bigger disconnect. It's not among the libertarians. I mean, there is a smaller gradient difference between the competing factions there than there is in the Democratic politics, the way I see it. Maybe I'm wrong about that again. But again, the only political entity that has a party name in this country that seems to act fairly uniformly is actually the GOP, despite their infighting. And the fact that they'll primary each other and everything else, at the end of the day, they will still end up, putting their toes on the same lines, for the most part. Whereas, you know, I mean, it's a circular firing squad with the DNC as a constant. They can't even stop shooting themselves in the feet and each other. Okay. And the libertarians just seem to be, you know, well, let's just kind of get swallowed up into this or that and don't wish to really assert their own identity. And when I was younger, I liked the Libertarian Party because, well, it's a far different thing. It's the only party I've actually ever registered with as a voter. But it was a far different thing. You know, the drug prohibition is nonsense. It's just that was a pretty good indicator of where they were at. Let's take a look at other things here and, you know, not necessarily go all for the left or the right wing program, but let's try and think outside of the box. And nobody paid attention to them. Right. They were a very small element, but I liked the concept in the 90s. Of what it looked like. But, you know, because again, I turned 18 in 1990, right? Was it 19? Yeah, 1990 I turned 18. So that's when I was able to vote and, registered as a libertarian and still pulled a switch for Bill Clinton. But anyway, that's what I did. And I was of that mindset where I voted mixed ticket on everything. And it seemed like that was part of what I should have been voting for all libertarian candidates, I know, but it didn't happen that way. Anyway, It's part of the very strange different time it was then when it came to the Libertarian Party versus what we see today. And I'm still amazed that Ted Metz got next to nothing in 2018 in the whole state of Georgia. But anyhow, not surprised Stacey Abrams lost. Because how do you go anti-gun in Georgia? I just don't get that. But anyway, I'm now thinking out loud about all kinds of things and forgetting that we need to get back at what it is you guys have been working on. And this is interesting. I'd like to see a long piece from you guys about it. And the gubernatorial rundown, I think, would be really interesting on the failed state update, because that would be an indicator of the bipolar nature of the different state races, for sure. And I think it's going to be interesting the way it pans out later on this year. Anyway, so that would be fascinating. But what else has been going on? Now, I know Parallax Views has had some interesting episodes as of late, including the one that I was pointed to that I talked about earlier, where somebody said, you know, you got to check out this guy that JG did some work on. But you're pumping out content all the time. What have been some of the latest highlights from the Parallax Views, JG?
There's a few episodes I'm really proud of lately. The big one for me was I had Daisy Pitkin on, who is actually in Pittsburgh. I just missed her. But it was funny. She has a book out called... I'm blanking on the title. But she's a union organizer, and she's involved in the whole Starbucks union wave and helping to organize that right now. Yeah. Her book is called On the Line, and it's about a union organization effort in Arizona. So that's an interview I'm really proud of, and I don't think you have to be super left-wing to enjoy that interview or find value in it. It's really about, a group of workers coming together to change unsafe working conditions and how they were able to do that. So that was an interview that I'm really proud of. I'm really excited about some of the other interviews I have coming up, though. I just spoke to Jefferson Morley about his new book, Scorpion's Dance, The President, the Spy Master, and Watergate. And Jefferson Morley, of course, has done a lot of work on the Kennedy assassination, although I'm more interested in the areas he covers that have to do with things on the periphery of the assassination. So the history of the CIA at the time, the history of Kennedy in Vietnam. But his new book is incredible. Right. It's basically... a biography of – it's a dual biography of Richard Nixon on the one hand, and then the CIA's Richard Helms on the other hand. And they're two characters that really understand, you know, the nature of power and clandestine sort of relationships.
Yeah, I was supposed
to work those relationships. Go on.
Right. No, I was supposed to talk to Morley last night about this. He missed his appearance, but we rescheduled him for Monday on that book on this show. I have a copy of that book as well. It is fascinating. I should probably listen to your interview before I talk to him.
Fascinates me so much is just like how, you know, Nixon and Helms are similar in so many ways, but they're also very different. Like, you know, Helms is the guy that comes out of like the Ivy League upper crust, whereas Nixon, Nixon was someone that notoriously was always kind of aggravated that he wasn't part of what Gore Vidal called the Eastern establishment. You know, that's why he had such a dislike of Kennedy, because Kennedy came from that sort of cultured elite, and Nixon was always very, I think, jealous of that. But it's interesting because they come from two very different sort of ends of the culture in America, and yet they're so similar. And of course, they come together in the scandal of Watergate. So I'm looking forward to releasing that interview. Mm-hmm. I also have an interview with William I. Robinson, who is a professor and sociologist that is writing his new book is called Global Civil War. And it's about the, nature of class warfare today in America.
Right.
And it's not just a lefty book. It's a very interesting sort of examination of the machinations of power in this country and how they're reacting to the uprisings that are sort of happening. Right. I mean, we sort of see global uprisings now. More people are becoming interested, in one hand, in this sort of populist right. On the other hand, you have a lot of people that are becoming interested in socialism now. So his book sort of deals with why we're seeing these sort of uprisings and the sort of power elite's reaction to those things. He's a very good author. Those are going to be coming out shortly. And really interesting book I had Nick Marks on recently, who has a really interesting book called That's Not Funny, How the Right Makes Comedy Work for Them. And that's a really interesting interview, because a lot of people think that comedy is something that is just done by, you know, enlightened liberals and left-wingers. But this book shows that viewpoint maybe neglecting that there is a growing sort of right-wing comedy complex in this country, represented by people like Steven Crowder, and then there's older folks, sort of the boomer conservatives like Tim Allen. But it's becoming a way to recruit people. So you have people like Steven Crowder doing basically right-wing comedy on YouTube and sort of using it as a means to recruit younger people into the sort of conservative and right-wing movements of America. And I think it's a really interesting topic, because I've noticed whenever I have someone like Nick to talk about that subject, people get really mad. They're like, no, all comedy punches up, you know? And I'm like, well, I think good comedy punches up, but there is comedy that punches down. And, you know, it is having an effect where, you know, a lot of kids are getting pulled in because they see the Steven Crowders and the Ben Shapiros of the world is like edgy, even though I don't think Ben Shapiro is edgy at all. But, you know, there is this sort of culture sort of coalescing around figures like Dave Chappelle now and Joe Rogan that's based on, oh, the edgy people that are going against the liberal cultural establishment. So that interview should be coming out shortly. That's what I have going on.
Right. And look, there's always anti-establishment stuff in comedy. I mean, honestly, I'd love to hear a fully unredacted conversation between you and Tim Pool. I think that would be funny. Although I don't think Tim Pool is all that funny myself. But, you know, what can I say? And the interesting point about that thing with Morley and that book is, I will never forget the at first it wasn't part of the theatrical release, but Oliver Stone's Nixon had this imagined interaction. Obviously, nobody ever memorialized this, but people mentioned it. This conflict between Helms and Nixon, and a meeting that could have taken place, which had the guy who, I can't remember his name now, but he used to be like one of the main people on the old Law and Order series. Sam Waterston. Waterston? Something like that. Did this incredible job of playing. He looks nothing like Dick Helms, but he's Dick Helms in this sequence which, again, I think has now been released, you know, as part of the director's cut, and probably if you watch the movie, they put it in full form now. But initially, it wasn't part of the theatrical release, and I think it illustrated perfectly this really odd parallel and yet conflict in the dynamic between these two guys. And of course, Stone took a long time showing the inferiority complex, you know, the repetition of, I'm from Whittier, California, and I was raised on the, you know, the poorest lemon ranch there was, and the whole bit.
Can I be honest about something? I honestly think that may be Oliver Stone's best movie.
I think it is one of his best, absolutely. Anthony Hopkins is Nixon in it, and I think that's no small contribution to the fact that it is a great movie. But Water, you've seen the sequence I'm talking about, though, right?
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, perfectly encapsulates what was happening, given the evidence we have. I, you know, it's obviously fictionalized, but it actually represents the reality perfectly, I think. And there is one of, yeah, that's one of Stone's best works, for sure.
I was going to say, too, the last thing I should mention, I'm sorry if my thoughts are a little bit scattered this time around.
But, no worries.
I was going to mention, too, and I think we may publish it on Field State Update, but I also just interviewed really interesting journalist from Texas, Dick J. Revis, who I think wrote the best book on Waco. It's called The Ashes of Waco.
Ooh.
And we did a long form interview. I think I kept him longer than he wanted to go, but you know, he was a good sport about it. And we sort of revisited Waco, and he has a lot of criticisms of you know, some of the ways that the right wing has talked about Waco. Not the right wing, but the sort of Alex Jones, Linda Thompson sort of types have talked about Waco and how they've sort of muddied the waters by stating things that can't be proven. Although Dick Revis himself, it's interesting. He's one of these, I mean, he's a old Democratic Socialist of America guy that also organized during the civil rights movement. But his view of Waco is that it was, you know, at best criminal negligence and at worst just an act of murder against the Branch Davidians. So that interview is going to be really interesting because I think he has a very different perspective on it, and he spent time with the surviving Davidians after you know, the compound was burned down and, you know, Koresh and company were gone. So that's going to be a really interesting interview, and he's not someone we hear from that often anymore, but back when Waco happened, he was involved in the investigations, and I think he testified to Congress and whatnot. So that should be a really interesting interview, and
see,
hopefully we'll cover that on Field State.
I'll tell you the truth. I have tried to get certain people on this show that were directly involved. I mean, the negotiator and everything, especially at the time that Paramount released that series on Waco. I was actively trying to get a bunch of people because they were just a little more accessible, I thought, and failed to get them on the show. You know, and some of these people that were involved are really not anxious to discuss things anymore at all, that are still alive. Now, I've seen, you know, other people get a hold of these guys, which is funny because going back to Joe over here, Joe Flatley. Well, you know what? I would love to see what happens if you put your very interesting writing skills to a long form about this, about the Waco situation historically, because I think you would come up with something nobody else has. I don't know why I think that exactly, but I think you would if you were actually to turn your attention onto it. Love to see somebody get behind that idea and pay you to do it, but go ahead. Yeah,
I was going to say, yeah, I think there is like angles to Waco that people have never looked at before.
Well, that's why I'm saying Flatley ought to look at it, because this is the guy to go for the angle nobody saw. So I'm just saying, because I would have never thought you could have even gotten as much as you did out of the, you know, out of Gabriel there. And that circumstance, just looking at that, I really feel as I'm serious. I think that.
I keep trying to bust in, and you guys keep talking over me, and then I realized I was muted, so...
Oh, that's what happened. Okay, because I just thought you were just sitting back, and... yeah, go ahead.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I addressed Waco a little bit in my book, Satan Goes to the Mind Control Convention.
Yes, you did.
Not an article about it, or, you know, a longer piece about it, but just... because, I mean, that was such a kind of fundamental part of me becoming a journalist, is like, you know, I was a weird kid, so... I was, in, you know, 18 years old, staying up to listen to William Cooper on shortwave radio.
Right.
midnight. And so, you know, I was listening while all the Waco stuff was going on. So, you know, I heard Linda Thompson, her craziness. And then, you know, I saw what was happening in the media. And even as like a kind of clueless, quite frankly, 18-year-old, I was something about how the media was covering it was just so bizarre to me.
Right.
And then, you know, seeing these people that, you know, these harmless weirdos burn alive, you know, and the way that nobody in my environment, parents, teachers, kids or whatever, anybody who mentioned them, mentioned Waco, it was kind of like a joke. Like, who are these crazy people? Oh, you know, they're playing slaughtered rabbit sounds and these boots are made for walking. And it's like, and it was really kind of mind-blowing because it really does represent, you know, the ugly truth of the fact that if you're different in this country, you know, nobody will care what happens to you. You know, it's like, I'm always amazed by if the right person dies, it's okay, you know?
Yeah.
It's just an ugly tendency that we have as Americans.
It's also really interesting with Waco, and I won't spoil the interview I did with Bravis, but what's interesting to me about Waco is, you know, I think a lot of people look at it and are like, oh yeah, they were just like far-right loonies. And I mean, they were Seventh-day Adventists, so they were very, they believed in a very certain theology when it came to Christianity and biblical interpretation. But it's not like they weren't exactly like they weren't like the far right in that they weren't like Aryan Nations types. You know, they weren't white supremacists. A lot of the people within the congregation were actually black and from marginalized communities, which is always interesting to me because I think a lot of people look at it and they're like, oh, just bunch of crazy white people, you know,
right.
Crazy white people, right wingers that probably believe in white nationalism, when really that wasn't what was going on. Yeah. And the other thing that I find interesting, and Dick Ravis and I talk about this, is that a lot of like militia types will say it was all about gun rights, and they'll talk about gun rights, and really like the Branch Davidians didn't really care that much about guns. I mean, they were storing firearms and then selling them. But like everything really came down to the Bible for them, and their very specific interpretations of the Bible that have a long history, actually dating back to the figure of Ellen G. White. But that's a whole nother story. It's interesting because I think a lot of people sort of politicize that story, and you know, it's not like we ever actually heard the sort of perspective of the Branch Davidians. I think a lot on the right just wanted to make it, these people were martyred because they loved their guns. But really, that wasn't what was going on.
That's why I kind of liked that Paramount series, because it at least gave a window in to, you know, yeah, it played up on a bit of the, okay, so I got to work on the Seven Seals, and this is part of my negotiation. Of course it did, because that was one of the main consultants, right, to the script. But the thing was, it was at least finally not just a complete dismissal of them as, you know, a right-wing fringe group, period. Because I didn't see him that way
that was
either.
Weird.
Yeah.
It was a weird show because it was like, I mean, it was a cult. I mean, you know, David Koresh is marrying 14-year-old girls, you know, but what, you know, nobody deserves to die in such a horrible way. And the fact of the matter is that if anything illegal was happening, it could have, you know, come out in court. In America, you're allowed to be in cults. You're allowed to believe that somebody has the direct line to God. But, you know, it was just that Netflix thing, or that whatever, was it on? I can't remember.
It was Paramount Netflix, Network at series, the time, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it was so weird because it was like, it really swung in the other direction. Like, I guess TV just can't do, American TV can't just do nuance. It has to be all or nothing.
Yeah. Yeah, but to me, it was like, at least it's an entry in the opposite direction from the standard narrative.
Well, I think what's interesting about it, too, and everyone thinks I'm crazy for saying this, but in some ways, I like to look at how Waco was handled and then how the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were handled. And people are like, what do you mean? How are those two things connected? But, I mean, when you look at it, the way that siege went down, the ATF didn't really think, oh, what is their mentality? Yeah, how are they interpreting these events, the people in the compound? Because they really did think in a completely different way than like you or I would think about things. So when the raid happens, they're thinking, oh, these are the armies of Babylon descending down on us. This is the apocalypse, right? And sure. Not understanding what these people thought probably led to further and further escalation. Even if we don't agree with the Branch Davidians, in order to have negotiated with them, you sort of have to understand who they are, what they think, how they're going to react to what you do. And I don't think that was done. And I think the same thing is true of Iraq. I mean, you had stories of soldiers riding around in vans that had Jesus killed Muhammad spray painted on the vans. And it's like, do you realize that this how this comes off to Iraqis? You know, if you're going to do a pacification campaign, this ain't the way to go about it. So I think it's interesting because I think it gives an insight into how not to negotiate or how not to deal with people that are from a different culture or mindset.
See, I dial this all the way back to the really pragmatic, right? Because, look, forget about their religious. Everybody puts the religious cult thing up front. How about we remove that from the equation for a moment and just say, look, people that choose to live within their own homes are suddenly under siege, okay? And whatever their belief system is, I mean, listen, if my house was suddenly surrounded by federal agents who were, you know, taking up that sort of posture and, you know, yelling at me through a megaphone and trying to make entries into parts of my house, I might interpret that in different ways depending on who I am. And when you're going to negotiate, you know, regardless of, oh, it's a religious cult, and that's almost irrelevant. They would have to know in order to, you know, pacify the situation with as little damage being done as possible. They would have to know who they're dealing with. Somebody would have to come in who understands my mentality if you're attacking my home, okay? And if I live in a group, well, then there's a group mentality there. Now, that could be a hippie compound. You know what I mean? That could be, in which case, it's probably not guns. But, you know, let's just imagine that there are other people out there that also think, you know what? Look, I want to go off the grid. And regardless of what my belief systems are, this is what I'm doing. You better figure out what it is they're thinking, not what you're thinking about what they're doing. So this view on the religious cult, it's significant, but it's not the only thing. And I think none of that stuff was actually really examined in this situation, at least from what I can tell. And even the negotiator who was attempting to understand what was happening was being discouraged all along the line. It's like, nah, it doesn't matter. It's just about the strategic situation. And it doesn't take into account exactly what's going on in the minds of the people who are now under siege, who, yes, indeed, might have interpreted that as a verification of some of the stuff that Koresh had been teaching them. And, you know, now put yourself in that position. You literally believe, you know, I'm going to really oversimplify and make this sound terrible, but you really believe the armies of Satan have descended upon you. You're going to react differently than maybe I'm going to be charged with something. Maybe this is, you know, something I can negotiate. There may be no point of negotiation there if they're locked in that belief, so you're going to have to work on it. But you better start from the overall mentality, not just the specifics of the religious, because you know what? It's difficult to understand a cult or, hell, man, I don't understand Mormons, okay? I really don't, and I try, but I don't, you know? I mean, I'm just saying, if we had a Mormon compound under siege, don't turn to me to figure out their mentality. I don't get it. You better get somebody who knows. And it's not just the religious aspect. Again, they may have done this because they thought, you know, look, society's getting too sick and we got to be ready for, you know, doomsday. They could be doomsday preppers and Mormons. They could be doomsday preppers and Branch Davidians. You know, there might be more to that mentality than just the key thing that you think is out of line. And without taking all that into account, you're not negotiating. You're just intimidating.
It's always fascinating to me because I think the one informant they had that went in, his name was actually Robert Rodriguez, not to be confused with the filmmaker. But
yeah. It was the same guy. it was the director of Spy Kids.
Okay, cool. Well, that makes sense. Yes.
He was like trying to get them to call off the raid. He said, "Don't do this. You don't understand how they're going to react." And he also would tell them, he's like, this is what they believe, this is what I'm getting from them. And they would say, none of this matters, we just have to do this, this, and this. So they didn't even listen to their own informants, which is really interesting to me. I think there was too much game theory going on with the Waco case, where they're like, nope, we have to do it this way.
Yeah, well, there you go. Sometimes you got to rewrite the playbook on the scene, and they didn't do that. Which, by the way, you know, Joe, see, you would be one of the few people who knows who Bo Greitz was at this point in time, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because there's another thing that was going on there. And again, I don't think this was politics. I don't think the religious aspect certainly played a role here, but I think that's an oversimplification. I think it's too easy an answer. And the idea that there are some people who say, nope, it wasn't a failure, you know. Like it was like the only people that I saw take notice of that, you know, locally to me, outside of myself, who were like horrified by it, and a few people were like, wow, that sucks. And you know, what's on Roseanne today? That's kind of what they did back then. I looked at it and I went, man, this is a precursor for other things that are going to come here. And there's going to be other justifications. And I saw it as the overreach of the government. And again, I'm not Mr. Right Wing, but that is attributed to just the right wing, end of the equation here all the time. Well, they saw it as Timothy McVeigh was there. You know, I mean, all here we go. Right. Maybe that's got something to do with what happened in Oklahoma. Boy, another can of worms. But I would love to see you kind of break this down and maybe even try and get a hold of some of these guys that, again, I got a hold of, but couldn't quite nail down for interviews.
Oh, sorry to cut you off.
No, please.
I just saw that PhaseShifter8 posted a chat saying that I need to get my ass out to Landers, California to investigate a UFO cult there. And
that's a
he
joke.
Posted that last time I was on too, they posted that. And I tried Googling it. I don't know what he's talking about.
Okay.
They're talking about.
Let me help.
Put that in the chat. That'd be cool.
Let me help you with that. That's a joke, Joe. That's definitely a joke he's trying to get you to take the bait on. Now you did. Just talk to Aaron Franz and mention that to him. And he'll know exactly.
Oh, so it's like an Ocelli Media joke.
They have acquired...
Landers, that's where the original contactees, there's a huge rock out there. All the original UFO contactees used to gather and have their conferences and stuff.
Right. The Franz family has purchased a property out there is what has happened. Okay. And so the joke is that they're going to start a UFO cult out there. Because that's something that Aaron would do. Just
yeah, that's too weird for this reporter.
Listen, if you want to put your time into that, Joe, who am I to tell you? But I love it. And there you go. You're like, I Googled it. I can't find it. No, you won't find it because it's just...
You gotta follow every lead.
Yeah, it's here in my chat room. That's about it. And every time Aaron's show comes on, people want the update on the UFO cult compound, which is just their Landers house. Although, I will tell you that they are planning on having, like, listeners come and camp in the, in the desert grounds around the new house. So, you know, who knows? Maybe I'm missing a part of the agenda that's going to be put in play here. There will indeed be a UFO cult, so keep an eye on it, Joe. But
we'll contact the Cult Awareness Network.
There you go. Or at least contact Aaron Franz and ask him about it, which, you know, that would be fun. But, no, I'm serious. I would love to see you delve into the Branch Davidian thing, like, especially if somebody would fund it. I think you would come up with a hell of a book on it. And you would look at it from a perspective that, even your alt media people would not. So, I really think that would be great. Anyhow.
I was going to say they still have, every year on the anniversary of what happened, the surviving, because there are still Koreshians out there. There are still Branch Davidians in Waco.
Yes.
I don't think a lot of people realize that. They get together on the anniversary every year. And it would be interesting to know what their story is or what they think about things now.
Yeah, but look, I would love to see that too. See, that's the thing. There's definitely enough material there that if Joe went at it, you know, from his way of doing things, he would come up with it with, again, a hell of a book. And it would go nicely on the shelf with, Gabriel, except you'd be talking about a more controversial subject,
not enough of those.
Yeah, I'm just saying.
I'm getting real sick of controversy.
Well, I understand.
It's a headache.
All right, all right. Well, fair enough. So what else is coming up on the failed state update, though, before we're out of time? Because we're going to go a little over the hour just for live listeners, but, you know, podcast form, you won't notice. But, yeah, go ahead, Joe. Tell us about what's coming up or whatever else it is you want to tell us.
Oh, well, I'm most excited about, and I need JG to get on the horn with me so we can record the intro for this episode, is Douglas Horn. Is that his name?
Douglas Horn,
yeah. And that it's interesting because I had had him on my show to talk about Pearl Harbor, and I said, Doug, I really want to have you on to talk about how you helped uncover the Northwoods documents, because it was him and the Chuck, you would know this better than I do, the I think it's the ARRB, the Assassination Records Review Board, that found out about Northwoods, the operation that, you know, could have gone into effect if it wasn't shot down, to essentially do a false flag and blame it on the Cubans back in, like, the 1960s. But right. It was fascinating to me because – and I'll let Joe go on after this. But it was fascinating to me because I think outside of the Kennedy assassination itself, I think people like Doug Horn, who were mainly interested in the assassination, actually helped us get documents that are of great importance to the historical record just when it comes to foreign policy. And I think that our conversation about Northwoods and how he helped uncover those documents really shows that. So
yeah, incrementally, Doug Horn, to give full credit, was part of the military records section of the Assassination Records Review Board. He was not the controller of that section, but was literally responsible for that, which included the autopsy, because that was conducted by, you know, a military agency, Navy. Right? You have the Naval Hospital, which took care of that, Bethesda. So, yeah, but the thing is, a lot of things that are not generally immediately recognized in that work are, indeed, the Northwoods document, which I bring up every time somebody mentions the ARRB, because a lot of people say, well, what point was there to this? You know, there's a lot of stuff. And I say, you know what? You guys are not taking into account a lot of the things that came out of it as a result. Not only do we have that, but we also have documents released in later years that showed, you know, not just paperclip. We all know about paperclip and the, you know, the use of Nazi assets by the U.S. government. We know about that. But, you know, there were elements of what the military was doing regarding surveillance and everything else, where they were evaluating people to be nearly psychotic and paranoid, and they were still recruiting them as intelligence assets. And this stuff comes up once you decode the cryptonyms in some of the stuff that, again, the ARRB surfaced, because there was a tangential connection to the Kennedy assassination.
Right. Well, that's what I found interesting about it, because I think regardless of what you think about the Kennedy assassination, you know, it's good that we got these documents about Northwoods.
Northwoods ARRB, being proposed.
Whatever you may think of the assassination, I think it served a certain public good. And it's interesting. People always said to me, wasn't it James Bamford, the guy who writes about the NSA, the reporter that writes about the NSA, who found those documents? No, Bamford found them from the ARRB.
Yeah, so, that's where he got
to clarify that. And I like Bamford, but people give him credit for that when it was really the ARRB that ultimately found it.
Right. You know, Jeremy Gunn, as the lawyer there, again, a bit higher up in the Assassination Records Review Board, which was literally an executive branch office, an executive branch agency created for this purpose. Yeah, actually surfaced a lot of things that, if one does search them properly, we'll find out, Northwoods is an incredible document, because it was literally a proposal, given to Kennedy by the Joint Chiefs of Staff to say, listen, we can justify an invasion of Cuba if we do XYZ. And, you know, for people who said, well, remote control planes, that's the thing of the future. Well, then why was the military proposing it in 1962? I mean, you know, I'm just saying, the military doesn't generally propose, like, let's just propose stuff we can't do. They don't do that. So there's a hint at, you know, again, not saying I even believe in the remote control plane aspect of 9/11, but don't dismiss the concept. Because if you're proposing that for Cuba in 62, I imagine, you know, technology would have evolved by 2001, okay, nearly 40 years later, you might think that there is a possibility that the military can actually do stuff like that, given that they're proposing it to the president. And Lyman Lemnitzer was a signatory on that. And and there's a bunch of documents like that came out. And again, I would love to hear this with you and Doug Horn, because you guys, this is the kind of thing that needs to be heard. And Doug has kind of gotten a little disillusioned, I think, with the Kennedy assassination, others that write about it, a lot of them. But there are some people who have seen the greater value in a lot of the work he did. And I'm not saying I agree with the guy on everything. I'm just saying you can't deny that he did the grunt work for really wrenching these things out of the hands of various government agencies in his role with the military records section. They did a lot of work. I mean, they failed on a bunch of things, but that was because of interagency resistance and a whole bunch of stuff. But Doug, because of his familiarity with military culture and literally having had military jobs in transportation and stuff like this, was extremely useful and a key member of the Assassination Records Review Board as far as doing the work that actually got some of these things liberated and have, you know, allowed them to see the light of day. Because without that stuff, I don't think it would have happened. So yeah, I would definitely advise people to listen to that. If you guys have a discussion about that kind of stuff, man, that's good. Joe, yeah, good call, good catch, and something I haven't been able to do, even though I've been more than willing to talk about it myself, because I recognize the value of this stuff. Talking to Doug Horn about it is probably a very eye-opening discussion, huh?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I think JG has had a front row to this. Every time I hear like a good speaker on the JFK assassination, pro or con conspiracy, I immediately are like, yeah, that's what I believe. So it's like,
yeah,
you know. So I was like, I was, you know, reading this stuff last week, and I'm like, yeah, you know, JFK was a hawk and he wanted to go into Vietnam and it doesn't make any sense, and you know, like the kind of Noam Chomsky line. Right. And then I'm like editing this Douglas Horn interview and I'm like, yeah, Chomsky doesn't know what he's talking about. He hasn't kept up to date with the research. So I'm perpetually flip-flopping on that. I'm like a Democrat. I'm a flip-flopper.
Well, and you know what? I can't blame you either, because there is constantly new stuff, not necessarily just about, okay, Dealey Plaza and blah, 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 blah. But I mean, you know, I recently had a guy on, a professor, you know, about certain affairs in the world who, you know, was discussing JFK versus Alan Dulles is the name of the book. And there is a new angle on that. And what the foreign
Indonesia
policy.
Angle.
Yeah, the Indonesia angle and the, you know, the foreign policy aspects here and the way that that played into maybe how it is. If you believe that there were people that thought he was going to be an inconvenient obstacle, Kennedy himself, a lot of different ways to break this down. And indeed, even in the past week, I've had somebody present to me stuff that was never transcribed but is available on audio that might suggest that maybe Kennedy knew a little more about the assassination of Diem and New than most historians and even JFK researchers ever realized. Because there's some interesting direct evidence that nobody wants to really bring out, because it sort of destroys this idea that that he was really upset and maybe absolutely out of the loop when Henry Cabot Lodge, who was the ambassador to Vietnam, might have allowed, you know, intelligence assets to kill the leaders of South Vietnam. yeah, there is always new stuff to be dug up, and again, some of these tapes of these meetings and things, really weird. Nobody ever transcribed them. They're just sitting there for years until somebody actually goes and digs. You're going to hear about this on my show in a couple of months, by the way, and it may be part of somebody's book. But anyway, the work does go on, and some of these historians who have made, you know, definitive declarations about it, yeah, they're not taking everything into account. And if you think, what is that, Ken Burns or whatever, you know, the definitive PBS Vietnam special that'll put you to sleep, yeah, if you think he got it right, man, oh man, that means that you never really read on the case. I gotta tell you, you never really read on Vietnam either, because it's not a continuation either. You know, oh, Kennedy started it, Johnson just ran with it. No, poor LBJ. Bull. Anyways, you guys, I appreciate everything. Is there anything else we should get to before we close out? Because I want to do that, let you guys go. I kept you a little long, but I started you late, so here we are. start with JG. Is there anything else we should throw in here? I mean, obviously, you're constantly at work. Parallax Views is constantly coming out with stuff. But the failed state update also. Anything we missed?
Just parallaxviews.podbean.com. And if you can, please consider supporting me on Patreon, patreon.com/parallaxviews.
Mm. Which I do, despite the fact that my Patreon has fallen off a little. Just saying. Anyway, Joseph L. Flatley, anything you want to throw in here before we're all done?
This is an urgent plea and appeal to the people of the Ocelli Effect, the listeners. Hmm. People listening live, people listening to the podcast, please subscribe to my newsletter. It's free. You can pay if you want. That would be great because God knows they need the money. But I need the subscribers anymore, even more. Go to LennyFlatley.substack.com. Show you care. Keep abreast of the failed state and, prove to Chuck that his audience is motivated and likes newsletters, I guess. I don't know. LennyFlatley.substack.com. Please, guys, please join.
I will make sure that link is in with the show notes. If you're listening to the podcast, take a look at the show notes. There will be a link you can click on to go straight to that. And also to Parallax Views, a couple social media things. But, I get the Failed State Update newsletter. You guys, I'm telling you, it's interesting, informative, and there's always something different in there, by the way. It's not just more of the same. You click on that, you're going to get something different. And, again, unique lens, unique work. These two guys as a dynamic together, interesting duo when it comes to the podcast. But the written newsletter is really fascinating, and I can't imagine. I mean, I don't know how hard it is to do that because I suck at writing, but honestly, it looks like it takes some effort because it is entertaining, interesting, and unique. So yeah, get the Failed State Update as a newsletter, as a podcast, all that. Support Joseph L. Flatley and JG Michael's work because there are not too many unique individuals out there. And what do you want to be stuck with? Tim Pool, Joe Rogan? And maybe I'll drop dead too, and that'll be it. You'll just be, there's your alternative. Nah, not really. Joseph L. Flatley, JG Michael, and also thanks to Glenn Viklund for joining me in the first hour. The Ocelli Effect is finished. And I am merely Ocelli. All of you are indeed the effect. Good night.